He talked to begin with about East London University and when you started.
Right, okay. Yeah, so through the whole time that I was living in Colville Road, I was my sort of main source of employment was part-time teaching and a fine art course at what was then called the North East London Poly to begin with, and later on Polytechnic of East London, and eventually the University of East London. And I'd actually started working there shortly after I left college in 1977, so I started working there in 1978, I think. I never really wanted to get a job, never really wanted to do teaching, and what happened was that I bumped into somebody who taught me on my undergraduate course, which had been at North East London, shortly after I'd left the RCA, and I'd had a film shown on Thames Television that I'd made, and I bumped into this man who ran this course, and he said, it'd be great if you could come in and do a day's teaching on our course. And basically he was saying that I think the students were kind of very unhappy with the course, and he sort of thought I might be one of the few successes that they'd had since they'd left. So he thought it'd be good to get back an ex-student who was like doing all right, or he seemed to, who he thought was doing all right. I mean, it was the only thing I'd done, just make this one film. But anyway, so I went and did this day's teaching, and just did some tutorials with people, and it was quite a nice day. But I'd always vowed not to do teaching. Anyway, I thought he meant, when he said come and do a day's teaching, I thought he meant come in for one day. So at the end of the day, he said, how'd it go? I said, yeah, it was fine. Thank you very much. I'll see you again sometime. And he said, I'll see you next week. I said, what do you mean? He said, I meant a day a week teaching. So so that's how I got sucked into teaching. And I've done it ever since.
Part-time. Why did you not want to teach? Because most people want to do something like that.
I don't know. I think it was sort of, I'd have to look back. I remember my thesis that I wrote at the Royal College. It ends up with saying something like, as long as I don't get a teaching job or apply for an Arts Council grant, I think I'll be all right. And both of those things are what I did shortly after leaving college. So I must have had some I think I had some sort of ideological objection to the kind of being part of the establishment at the time, you know, and I kind of saw being a teacher as part of the establishment. Although I'd had some very good teachers myself at college that I'd really respected. So not quite sure what it was, but I think it was to do with actually, I know what it was. I'd written, my thesis had been written about how people get pigeonholed in terms of profession. And I mean, certainly wouldn't have called myself an artist at the time. I might have called myself a filmmaker. But I didn't see that that was what I was likely to do for the rest of my life. So I didn't, I was rather against kind of being kind of stuck in any kind of creatively getting stuck in a position which kind of which linked employment and what I was doing creatively. I didn't want to be kind of dependent. I wanted to keep kind of creative work as a separate thing. And that was like, of course, once I'd left college and I'd been signed on for a few months, I started to think differently. But at the time I was quite idealistic about it, and I remember when I first left college, it was strange as well, because, as I say, shortly after I left college, I made this film for Thames Television, which meant I had to become self-employed. So I signed off, and I had to go and see an accountant, become self-employed. And all of a sudden, I had a profession of filmmaker. And I found this really odd, that all of a sudden I've got this profession. I'd never thought of myself in that way, you know. It's like, and although, I mean, I've been kind of boringly consistent for the last 30 years in doing the same thing, that would be a big surprise. Would have been a big surprise for me then. I thought, oh, maybe I might go and write a novel, or maybe I might go just live in a teepee in Wales or something. You know, it's like all of those things were kind of possibilities. You know.
But I think that's sort of what's quite interesting about that time, because don't you think that kind of those ways of thinking have sort of slowly become lost?
Absolutely, yeah, completely, and it's something that I really you know, although I realised that I was kind of very, you know, kind of quite, in some ways, quite privileged in a way, at a time when, you know, you could live cheaply and, you know, you could sign on without, you know, having to go for job interviews and things all the time. I must admit, I'm very, I'm very aware of the changes, and I feel as though things have kind of gone post Thatcher, I suppose, things have gone kind of very much the other way. And the thing that really, really notices, I suppose, is that teaching in an art school, how students have changed over that period of time since I started teaching. Basically, you know, when I went to art school, it's because I didn't want to get a job. I wanted to delay going to work, you know, was the main reason for doing it. Now, students, and for many years, students come to college with the idea of, okay, I'm going to, you know, I teach on a fine art course. Those students are coming in, they're saying, I want to be an artist. And they're kind of, that's how they see they're thinking of a career path when they walk in through the door. Which, of course, is fine. But, I mean, I still believe very strongly that the creativity has to come before employment and material gain, you know. Like, if you're thinking about how do you make money from what you do creatively, then you're obviously much less likely to be adventurous about what you do. So I think that's changed an enormous amount. Yeah.
And sort of about the technology as well, because at the time, you was working 16mm. Are you still working?
I haven't done for about 10 years now. Although I keep meaning to go back and work on film again, but no, I've been working on video. So, I mean, that's one of the other, many ways, great changes that's happened. You know, because when I first started making work, I was completely dependent on being able to get external funding to pay for the work, and it's very, very expensive to work on film. Now, once you've got invested in a computer and a cheap digital video camera, you can make work for nothing, you know, so it's much more, there are many, many more opportunities for people to be able to actually make work now anyway. So that's really, really changed. I mean, myself included. I mean, you were saying earlier about all that funding I used to apply for. I did apply for some funding for something this summer, but it's the first time I've applied for anything for 7 years. I've just been making work, which basically hasn't cost much to make, and been able to do it off my own back rather than think about applying for funding for it.
Yeah. So what kind of camera was you using when you was in Culver Road, like when you filmed the hospital? Was that a Bolex or something?
Sometimes a Bolex, sometimes an Arriflex, yeah. I mean, I could have shot everything on the Bolex because basically a Bolex camera is a great camera, but it's no good if you're recording sound at the same time. You can't record sync sound with it, or even if you do, the camera's so noisy, you know, that it's a palaver anyway. So, but the things that I've done on film, I've never recorded sound at the same time for most of what I did, certainly for The Black Tower and Blight. I could shoot them on a Bolex camera on my own, so it's a small, lightweight camera. Because I don't like working with other people, basically, but I prefer to do things completely on my own. So if you've got a compact camera and don't record sound at the same time, you don't need anybody else to help you.
Because I suppose also, like, in that period, it was all, like, independent film. And, like, now the whole genre of filmmaking is really, like, production teams and...
Yeah, well, it's gone two ways, really, I suppose. You've got the whole sort of much more kind of conventional, kind of industry-based kind of crew world, and then you've got the artists working for the gallery at the other extreme. But even then, I mean, a lot of artists making work for gallery don't actually ever touch the technology themselves. They get other people to shoot stuff and edit for them, things like that. But that's sort of quite a big divide that's happened. And I mean, one, Channel 4 is largely responsible in a way for that split, really, in a way, amongst independent filmmakers, in that, you know, prior to Channel 4, there were lots of people making all kinds of work that were not really, you know, they were making work on a shoestring. And then Channel 4 came along, and suddenly the people making more political work started to get funding. The workshops, independent work film workshops that were, you know, workers' film groups and things like that, started getting funding from Channel 4. And then the artists kind of became sort of marginalised at that point, really, in a way. And it's only kind of, they've only kind of come back into the mainstream over the last, you know, few years, where, as we know, artists' film and videos, you know, a very big part of the contemporary art world. In my opinion, largely because the art market has found a way to actually commodify it and make it something they can sell, which they've never done before. So.
Yeah, because that whole practice in that period in the mid-80s was so different. It was much more process-based, wasn't it? Because you talked about these students that come in and want the career at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Negate the kind of creative, the kind of longevity of the creative process. Also, going back to Colville Road and the people you remember, the local people, because I wanted to know what your involvement was with the public inquiry, or if you wasn't involved, who you knew were.
I wasn't very involved in the public inquiry at all, although I did go along. I went along to some meetings, like when they had these sort of major meetings at the I think Stratford Town Hall and Leighton Town Hall. I went along to those, but I wasn't involved in the kind of road protest at the time, where, you know, sort of, because a lot of people were sort of demonstrating outside the Department of Transport and things. But also, a lot of people put a hell of a lot of work going into actually a legal opposition, finding ways of legally opposing the road, and before the direct action came along towards the end. And so, you know, for example, Ian Bourne, who was very involved in the campaign, he made a list of all the trees and the varieties of trees in the back gardens along the route of the road, and sort of listed, you know, sort of 700 of these, 340 of those, you know, and kind of made this kind of catalogue of the, and lots of people did things like that. So sort of in some ways, you know, sort of took a kind of slightly off-centre approach, but also him and lots of other people. People like Matthew Hale, who spoke about, was involved, and who else? I think George Saxon and Johnny Briscoe were used to go to a lot of the inquiry meetings as well.
So that cataloguing of trees, it sounds like a conceptual artwork.
Could be an artwork, yeah.
That was put forward to the public inquiry.
Yeah, because it was an environmental concern. You know, I mean, one of the things that, as you probably know, and one of the reasons that they got away with building the road was that they didn't call it a motorway. They called it a motorway link road. And that meant that they could actually bypass, they basically got around loopholes in the law. And one of the things was, if you're going to build a motorway through a suburban or urban area, you're supposed to do an environmental, under European law, you're supposed to do an environmental impact assessment, which would take in account things like, you know, as well as its effect on the community, what you were doing to the natural habitats of animals and birds, and what you're doing to flora as well as fauna. So that was kind of perfectly legitimate within that context, to bring up, to mention things like trees. But they never did an environmental impact assessment because they said, oh, it's not a motorway, it's not applicable, as far as I know.
And you mentioned that you went to some meetings at the town hall. Weren't they the public inquiry meetings?
Yeah. But there were. But what I was saying is, there were a lot of people really doing a lot of work to actually present stuff at the meetings and stuff like that. I mean, I just used to go along and, you know, heckle and make a press. I can't remember ever saying anything myself at the meetings, whereas, you know, some people were very, very active. And it was more or less a full-time job for a lot of people. Not so many artists, actually. I don't think there were that many artists who were really actively involved in the campaign, apart from the ones that I mentioned. There are a lot of other people, a lot of people from other road protests, actually. There are people from the Archway Road, there have been a number of protests on the Archway. A lot of people kind of came from there. A lot of kind of quirky characters who actually sort of enjoyed the the battling with the legal bureaucracy and stuff, which never really appealed to me, I have to say. I was pretty selfish about it all.
You mentioned Sheila Thompson,
mm-hmm,
and her involvement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What do you remember about Sheila?
Well, I remember she was always sort of very active in terms of initially, because it was interesting how the kind of protest against the road sort of shifted over the years. And to begin with, I think before the big public inquiries, I can't remember, well, there might have been, you know, an initial public inquiry and then something else happened. But I remember her kind of contacting local councillors and trying to get local councillors to actually support the campaign. And so I remember, for example, going around her house one day and she just sort of told people on the street that, you know, this boat was going to come round and we all sort of talked to him about how important the community was and things like that. I mean, it was sort of, that kind of strand was much more on a kind of personal human level of kind of appealing to the powers that be, which of course, you know, we knew from the beginning really was not going to have any effect. The only way to fight it would be to actually legally be able to stop it. And then, of course, at the end, the most effective thing was the direct action movement. That many people were very much didn't like those people. I mean, there were people coming in from outside too, and as part of the, although, you know, they had more effect than anything else, a lot of people resented the fact that they were coming into the houses and, like in Claremont Road, you know, actually destroying the houses as, yeah, they couldn't. Making them uninhabitable through kind of building towers onto the top of them and doing all these things to actually create a kind of stronghold. which I think, you know, in retrospect was politically very valuable and had much more effect on kind of general public consciousness than anything that those of us who'd gone and done things through kind of public inquiries and things had done. Because it made the news and people were very aware of it, and and now environmental issues are much more the norm rather than things that eccentrics used to be involved in as far as the mainstream is concerned. I think, you know, that they've made an enormous difference to shaping public consciousness.
You mentioned Henry Cox. Did he have a cafe in Claremont Road?
I'm not sure about that. I very rarely used to go down Claremont Road, to be honest. It became sort of after sort of other people moved in and stuff. It was like, in fact, it was strange because people moved in from outside and became kind of fiercely territorial about it, actually. So it was kind of there was a scene. You know, there's a lot of young people smoking a lot of dope and things as well, you know, so you know, people would be kind of a bit suspicious of somebody you didn't know going down that street, I think. So I never sort of felt it was a kind of, maybe wrongly, but I never felt it was really that open. So I wasn't aware of a lot of what went on down there, you know. I could probably count on fingers of one hand the number of times I went down Claremont Road after it became more of a kind of, you know, passport to Pimlico sort of environment. Did it declare itself a free state? I think it did declare itself a state of Claremontia or something, I can't remember. are now entering, it was, wasn't there? There were sort of banners up saying, you're now entering the Republic of Claremont or something. Oh, it was that.
So did it feel like walking in someone's living room or something?
A bit. I can't remember really. I didn't really have much to do. I mean, I wasn't that interested in going down there, to be honest. Apart from it was an amazing spectacle. I mean, it's like going to a kind of medieval encampment, really. So you sort of built a pond in the middle of the street and had bonfires in the street. Because the road, you know, towards the end was completely, there was no access through the road. So, and I think the people who lived there just did it. You know, they just sort of dug up the road. And it's like that for kind of 1 or 2 years.
Because Ian Bourne lived down that street, didn't he?
Ian lived down this sort of not on the back part of Claremont, but on it's off of Grove Green, yeah. But he, when George Saxon moved out from his place in Grove Green Road, Ian took on that from Acme. I think he'd had enough of being in Claremont, actually, because it was hard to sleep at night. Basically, you know, because you did get raves going on all night and things on a very, very regular basis. And there was a fair bit of kind of heaviness as well, you know. I mean, it wasn't all peace and love at all. There were some sort of fairly wild characters around, and as you know, it only takes 1 or 2 people to kind of really pollute those sorts of utopian situations.
Because I'm thinking about residents like Mrs. Swift and Sheila Thompson.
Mm.
Do you know what their view was on the road protesters? Because
the later group of road protesters, I think they didn't have any time for them at all. No, I think they were sort of. I mean, that's what I was sort of saying really about the beginning when I kind of first moved in there, and you know, the people, the long-term residents were kind of quite, you know, sort of suspicious and hostile towards me. I think that sort of later on, you know, I became sort of, you know, a reliable local figure because of all these new people that moved in, you know. So like all of a sudden I was like older generation rather than the
And
crusty.
Did people used to have like meetings in each other's houses? Because apparently there was an office in Colville Road in Reg Thompson's house, and I don't know if he was Sheila's partner or I don't know if you know.
I don't remember Sheila having a partner, but I might be wrong. I don't know. But it wouldn't have been surprising if it had been her house, certainly. I couldn't tell you about that. I mean, to be honest, I did sort of keep my distance from a lot of what was going on there. You know, probably just for selfish reasons, so I didn't really get sucked in too much into stuff, you know.
So. Yeah. Do you think some of the artists were quite attached to their houses by the time, because you, like yourself, was there 12 years in the
end. I can only really speak to myself for myself, really, because by the end, I was happy to go. Just because the house was falling down around me, apart from anything else, you know, and it was like it wouldn't have been. You know, the amount of repair it needed and stuff. And things had just been going on for so long. And I kind of thought, I don't want to be. Maybe that was one of the reasons I didn't get that involved in the campaign as well. I didn't want to feel as though I was a victim of the situation. You know, I mean, actually, I had a really good deal. You know, I got a really cheap place that, you know, was really useful for me for a long period of time. Made lots of friends there. You know, it's like, I couldn't get indignant for myself about being evicted from the place, and I was just happy when, I mean, obviously I would have been more attached to the place if I'd been thrown out, didn't have anywhere to go, but basically I found, you know, I sort of managed to raise enough money for a deposit on a flat and thought, I'm so glad I can get out, actually. You know, I thought, I'm going to just go around the corner. It was a shame to, because that, by that time when I left as well, like the community of artists was really starting to fall apart as well. Lots of people were moving out, yeah. Moved out before me, you know. I mean, I left in 1994, so it was like, and, you know, by the time I moved out, half of my street had been knocked down around me, you know, so including the house next door, you know. By the end, I didn't have a romantic attachment to the house, although from the beginning I did, you know, right when I first moved there, I thought, oh, this is a really nice street, there's a real sense of community around here, it's very established and it's all going to be destroyed, this is a terrible thing, and for, you know, a few years kind of sort of tried to keep optimistic about the fact that, you know, it would actually, the road would be stopped. But by the time most people moved out, everything had fallen apart so much anyway, that it wasn't really, you know, you couldn't have rebuilt that community, I don't think. You know, it was become so fragmented, you know, people had moved away, and, you know, long-term residents as well as the artists that I knew and things. So it was kind of about time when it happened, I thought, really.
Circumstances in which you kind of left. Can you remember your last day there?
Yeah, I remember my last day very well because I basically had been making, I'd made a series of video pieces in the house, and it was a series called Home Suite, and it was a suite of three pieces, and kind of pun on, you know, Home Sweet Home, yeah. But it was shot in the kind of, the first part was shot in the toilet of the house, the second part was shot in the bathroom, and I planned to shoot a third part in the kitchen, and it was all to do with basically the fact that the house was completely falling apart, and it was like unbelievable, you know, that sort of thing of like you get used to something in reality, I kind of realized, you know, at a certain point I thought, God, I am really living in this terrible slum, and it was when people came around, I think it was so embarrassed. Yeah. But so I decided I was going to film it, and sort of, because I could have, and even now when I look at that video, I think I can't believe that I lived there, you know, it was it was like a forerunner of changing rooms, basically. So I filmed the place and talked about the decorative details of the house, which was all to do with like it being complete. But I sort of spoke about proudly about the slum, yeah, and also told stories about things that happened in the house, personal sort of autobiographical things. But anyway, the last day that I was there, basically I decided I was going to do this final part in the house, and I thought I was going to start in the kitchen, but at the end of the video I'm going to go out in the street and walk to my new flat. So it was like a 5-minute walk. I'm going to walk down the street and actually kind of give a context of what's happened earlier. And so I'd moved almost all of my stuff out. I had to give the keys back to Acme later that day. But I was preoccupied with making this video. So I got up and started filming in the house, filmed in the kitchen, and went out through the front door. And I opened the front door, and unbeknown to me before then, that was the day that they were going to evict all of the people who were squatting in Claremont Road, the first major eviction. So that when I opened the front door of my house, I hadn't looked out the window that morning, the whole street was lined with police transit vans all the way down the street, both sides. My car was stuck there, so I couldn't actually get my car out of the street because it was blocked by the police. And I walked from my road down the end of the road, past Claremont Road to Twickenham Road, which is where I was moving to, with the camera running, and sort of documented everything that was going on, but all these hordes of police coming past me with carrier bags full of people's possessions that they were evicting. And then when I got up to Claremont Road, they were up the trees, sawing the trees down, to stop people being able to kind of climb into the trees from the houses. Police cordons across the street. It was this mammoth exercise. There must have been 1,000 police at least everywhere. It was just extraordinary. And I kept the camera running. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go into Claremont Road. Coming back to what we were talking about earlier. So I went up to the barricades at Claremont Road, where people who were living in Claremont Road were kind of throwing furniture and stuff frantically to go build up this barricade. And I was filming and talking about what was going on. All of a sudden, there was his hand over the lens of the camera. And I sort of thought, what's going on here? And this bloke pushed me. And I looked around, and it was this French guy who was like one of the squatters in the street. He said, hello, what are you doing? Who are you? So, I mean, fair enough, the police were doing surveillance by that time, and maybe he thought I was, working for the police. But it was kind of quite interesting in terms of those different kind of levels of being a local resident, so I said, oh, I live here. I'm just filming what's going on.
And it's, I was really amazed as you were telling that story how the police didn't stop you. You know, that you walked through all those police.
Well, they had enough to think about. I mean, it's very interesting, the whole... I mean, coming back to sort of whether I was attached to the house and things. I mean, when I was filming Blight, so I was filming demolition of houses, part of it. And there's one part in the film where the demolition workers pushed down this great, really big wall. Mm-hmm. And that was actually the house next door to me. So the reason I managed to get lots of close-up shots of the demolition people and stuff like that was that I was sort of filming out like the window of my bathroom looking down or from my back garden. The shot where the wall comes down, I'm standing in my back garden just looking across the fence at that.
So your house was still standing?
Yeah. And they were demolishing the house next door. God. That's one of the reasons. I mean, it worked very well for the film because there are, but I don't know whether you remember, but there's like bits in the film where the guy's kind of like trying to disconnect a bit of guttering, and he's like sort of like, this is kind of an evil looking, kind of really macho kind of bloke, but he's being kind of quite sensitive with he's trying to disconnect this bit of gutter. And the reason he's doing it is that I'm living in the house that's my gutter and I'm filming him. So I'm observing. So one of the reasons they're not being kind of brutal as they might be is because that house is still inhabited, you know.
And, did they speak to you or anything?
Yeah, well, I had sort of dialogues with them, and that's what I was saying. It came out what you were saying about the police not stopping me filming, was that it reminded me that I had this strange thing with, I was sort of filming, I just started filming them. And they were kind of looking at me kind of suspiciously, you know. Mm. And then I said, look, I'm making this film, I'm filming the houses being knocked down, stuff like that. I said, when are you going to push that big wall down? And I think one of them actually said to me, he said, everybody else around here is trying to stop us doing it, and you're wanting us to do it. So by that time, I was just wanting, you know, yeah, go, smash it up. Let me go. I want to film it. So I was sort of against the grain of, it must have been strange. There were lots of people, you know, the majority of people are trying to stop what's going on. And I'm just sort of asking the demolition people, kind of, oh, you're going to push me, you're going to knock that one down soon.
That is so weird. So the whole street started to become like this film set for you.
Yeah. No, it was
when
very strange.
When did you actually, I mean, so you spent this period of time filming the inside of your house on the day that you used to go. Then did Roger come to get the keys and they sort of ripped it up?
Yeah, that was later. Yeah. So what happened was after that time, because everywhere was getting squatted immediately, what happened by the time that I moved out was that the Ministry of Defence were employing African security guards to live in the houses because the bricking up wasn't working for the people who were still squatting them. So basically they had all these guys who kind of like, who I suspect were kind of working for a private company, probably illegal immigrants, earning almost nothing. Probably they may have well been refugees from a war zone somewhere. All of a sudden they're in London, you know, protecting these houses and kind of like wondering why everybody's aggressive towards them, and a horrible situation for them as much as anybody else. Yeah. So yeah, they That was what happened the day after I moved, or the day I moved out. Then security guards moved into the house, and they lived there until it was actually demolished a few weeks later.
Did you see it demolished, your own house? Or?
No, but I saw it in different stages of demolition. Mm. And I mean, my own house is one of the houses you see in Blight, actually. Because I started filming before, while I was still living there, for about a year. I mean, the filming, overall filming period is about 2 years. So a lot of it is filmed while I was still living there. The other houses around, mainly in my street. But then there are later bits which were shot after I'd moved out, where I'd sort of come back from. It's handy just living around the corner, because I could just walk down the street and see what was going on. And,
so what period is that? Is that like...
94. From 93 to 94 I was filming.
So, I mean, how did they take down Colville Road? Did it happen... in blocks? Or?
All bits and pieces. I mean, it was strange. I mean, I was surprised that they knocked down the house next to me while I was still living in it, for example. I mean, it was a bizarre thing to do, you know, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because, you know, a terraced house with a kind of a, not much of a wall between the two, you know. I was quite worried that my house was going to fall down, but they... And then after I moved out, I think they knocked... I think the one on... Yeah, I don't think they knocked down the one on the right of me. They knocked down the one on the left, where that family had lived. Because that's what the Exorcist poster on the wall in Blight is. I think it was that boy, John's bedroom, the teenage boy of that family with the woman who died. So that was interesting, that thing of, like, what I was saying earlier about exposing somebody's private world to the to the outside. You know, it's just very bizarre that I remember the day that I filmed that. That was the first thing that I filmed for Blight, because I'd been thinking about making it for a while. But then I came home one night, and next door had been empty for a week or two or something. But I came home one night, and they'd started demolishing the house. And I sort of walked out into my back garden, you know, just as the sun was going down. And I looked up, and, like, the roof was missing, and there was this wall. It just had this image of the poster for The Exorcist, which became this kind of incredibly kind of poignant thing, you know, especially because the guy on the poster is like the Exorcist and silhouetted with his trilby hat and briefcase and overcoat. Kind of made me think of, like, the guy, the bureaucrat from the Department of Transport who'd ordered the demolition of all the houses.
God. So it sounds like, you know, one odd house might be taken down, and then a little row or something in the order that people left.
Yeah, it was, yeah. And it was very much to do with, well, let's knock them down before somebody squats them, you know. So it was all very much, it was all sort of piecemeal bits and pieces. You never knew what was going to happen next. And very often, very quickly, you know, when they'd start on one house. And then, so it was...
It's interesting, because those houses were never built in the order that they were numbered. It was built depending on if the farmer who owned the field actually agreed to sell that field. So some of them
really?
Actually hung out for a long time to get a decent price.
Oh, really?
So you'd get a few houses built, and then a gap where a field hadn't been sold. So
I didn't know that.
So
it went back to a similar thing later, with all that sort of breaking down of the uniformity of it.
Yeah, what about sort of people like Mrs. Swift? And, I mean, do you remember them leaving, or Richard Layton?
Richard, I don't remember him leaving. I remember when... Oh, sorry, of course I do, yeah, because that's when his mum... There was this whole thing with them, his mum having a... possibly having a heart attack or whatever. And no, I remember that eviction, because that was very big. News crews and everything were down there, I think, when that happened, because I think Richard knew it was going to happen, and he sort of deliberately kind of, you know, sort of quite strategically kind of thought, okay, this is going to be good propaganda, my 85-year-old mother being sort of, and they could have, you know, police knock the door down and, you know, like, treat it like it was a crack dealer or something, you know. So, yeah, no, I remember that very well. And they knocked his house down really quite quickly after they moved out. Because he owned that house, you know, his mother owned that house. Yeah. That was, they were the only owner-occupiers left in Colville Road who ended up not accepting the compulsory purchase money.
So he was the militant farmer.
Yeah.
Do you remember Mrs. Switch? What happened there?
But Mrs. Swift, was it Mrs. Swift who was agoraphobic?
Yeah.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right, yeah. And I'd forgotten she was called Mrs. Swift. Yeah. I did know at the time, I wasn't there when it happened, but I know that they had to sort of deal with it very carefully because she was totally traumatised by, you know, just the thought of leaving the street. And I think there was some big procedure about getting her into a car or a van and gently easing her out. And, I seem to remember Sheila saying that she was okay after she moved. It wasn't sort of...
Because there were more dread in that, weren't there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And...
I've got a feeling of her driving off, but I might be imagining it, just because it was such a kind of poignant thought of like having to, because she literally hadn't left the street, had she, for years and years and years. Really.
And then Graham Miller, was she there when Graham?
I can't remember the chronology of it, yeah, but I mean, I knew very well about what happened with Graham and things and.
From your memory?
Well, basically, again, it was like the police breaking down the door. And there was something, I think that, I can't remember the details of it, but I think there was some, the police had it in their idea that, it had it in their heads that Graham's house was like the centre of the coordination of a road protest, where it's basically, you know, a couple and their disabled child living.
Yeah.
Living in the house, but I think there was something of, you know, that they thought it was kind of a hotbed of revolution, and they basically just really, I think very early in the morning, just broke the door down and came in and sort of, I can't remember whether it was sort of truncheons and riot shields akimbo or something, but it was a very, very dramatic event, and I know it was sort of completely traumatised them, and they weren't expecting it to happen that day.
No.
And I think they were in the process of, I think because Gabriel, their son, was disabled, they were going to get council housing, and I think they were in the process of that going on, and they'd informed the Department of Transport and everything, I think, and I think it was just some very kind of inexcusable mistake had been made, as far as I remember. Mm. But I'm sure Graham could tell you all about it. There was also a TV documentary made about his eviction. Did you ever see that? Oh, I've got it somewhere on VHS. Okay. But somebody made a film about it.
Right. Yeah. Was it an artist? Or?
No. It was a conventional TV. I think it was somebody that he knew might have been the director of it. I can't remember, but it's.
Was that the one that talked about Dolly Watson and Mrs. Swift's situation?
I can't remember.
Okay.
I can't remember. Quite likely. I don't think it was, you know, completely. It was sort of used, I think, as far as I remember, it used Graham and Mary's situation as a kind of central thing. And then it did. That's a long time since I saw that. I can't remember.
I mean, did you ever feel a bit unnerved at any point? Or do you think you was just engaged in what you was doing and...
Yeah, I think sometimes like there are points where you think, oh, it's getting a bit dangerous around here,
yeah.
You know, and you didn't really know. I mean, as far as I wasn't fearful of, you know, the police knocking the door down or anything, because I had, you know, I had an agreement with ACME when I was going to move out and things like that. So, and I think I actually left before I got an eviction notice, although it would have been very soon after that. But Yeah, because actually, now come to think of it, I bought my flat in January 94, and I actually moved from my stuff out of Colville, finished moving stuff out in July. So basically, I was living in Colville and doing up the flat around the corner. Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people complained that they were being filmed.
Sorry?
Some people complained that they were being filmed, quite obviously. To do the Department of Transport. Did you get any of that? Because you was the one doing the filming.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, generally, apart from the thing that I talked about on the eviction, which I shot with a little video camera, I was generally filming with a Bolex film camera on a tripod, you know, it wasn't, and I was like setting the camera up in the street, and I'd been doing it for years, you know, since 1980, or two when I first moved in, I'd been filming that area in the street, so people knew me as, you know, a local kind of weirdo filmmaker. So nobody really knew what I was doing, but they knew it wasn't for the authorities.
So did sort of going back to sort of Housewatch, because they did a piece which I think you was involved in Claremont Road.
I wasn't involved in that at that time, no. And in fact, at that time, I didn't really know the people involved in Housewatch when they did that first piece. But the first, basically, Housewatch made a series of pieces of work which involved, most of which involved projection, back projection into the windows of buildings. And the first, they called it cinematic architecture for pedestrians. And the idea of the first Housewatch thing as well, and a lot of the other ones later, was that basically they would do something and what they were most interested in were passers-by kind of noticing what was going on. So the group of people that were involved in Housewatch when it first started, which who were Ian Bourne, Alison Winkle, George Saxon, what's his name? That great White, John White, I think his name was, did the first one. And Tony Sinden and Lulu Quinn. Each made individual projection pieces which were shown in the windows of the house. And I remember going to that performance really well because I didn't really know them at the time. It was sort of late at night. It was, I think it was actually after the pub came out, or maybe it had been running all evening, but I remember being in the north. I knew that this was going to be happening, but a lot of people didn't. So people would come out and be walking down the street and see something going on and walk down the street and basically witness these projections in the windows of the house, which were very spectacular because it was just in a little suburb. It was, you know, it was Ian Bourne's house that they did the first one in, and all the windows of the house had projected images in them, and some of them were very dramatic. I mean, I think it was Alison Winkle's one at that time involved. It was like a scene. It was revolved around Wuthering Heights, and it was a scene with the house burning with a fire, and so all the windows had flames in the windows.
Was Alison living around there at the time?
No, but she was friends with George Saxon, I think. I can't remember, but they were a group of people who knew each other anyway. But no, it was only George and Ian who were living locally. But I'm not even sure if George was living there then. I think he was, but oh, sorry, and that other guy, John. I think it was John White. He also lived in Claremont Road. But I remember it being a really interesting performance because a lot of people were coming by and just didn't know what they were looking at all. I mean, it was sort of, we're talking about, you know, a time when sort of, you know, film installation was not known to the general public at all, you know, so. And I do remember standing in this crowd of people, sort of in their over, because it was in the winter, I think. I remember being quite cold, and somebody saying, "Well, I bet I got an Arts Council grant for this." What is this going on? What's all this? But it was great, the kind of different groups of people who attracted.
Are you originally from London, John, or East London?
Yeah, I'm from Walthamstow. Yeah, I was born in Walthamstow, so I haven't got very far. Yeah, East London, born and bred, never left. I've never lived. I mean, furthest away I've ever lived was North Chingford.
Yeah.
And I mean, Hackney was the most central I've lived. So probably what we're talking about, 10 miles.
Yeah.